The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll begin with an article titled The Wild Harvest by Kate Olson. In Maine, an unusual convergence of farm workers renews an ancient and increasingly threatened agricultural practice. Brian Johnson arrived at the wild blueberry camps on a warm August night in 2023. It was around 1 a.m. Exhausted from the 9-hour journey in his friend's truck, he fell asleep on the floor of the mess hall. Someone shook him awake around 5, asking, "Are you here to work?" He nodded yes. Johnson, a 42-year-old Nikamach fisherman of the Eskasoni First Nation in Nova Scotia, Canada, had grown up hearing about harvesting blueberries in Maine. His parents and grandmother came down every summer to work for several weeks, saving their earnings for school clothes and other expenses. Everyone he knows in Eskasoni had, at one point, made the trip for the harvest, simultaneously a working vacation, a source of extra income, and a cultural ritual. But with a wife and 7 kids at home, it was hard to get away. When he finally found the time, he hit the road with nothing but a sleeping bag and a few sets of clothes. "I was scared," he told me. "I was scared that I would have no place to sleep. I was scared that I wouldn't have a rake. I was scared that I went there for nothing. But I had faith in good people." Johnson is one of the thousands of people who show up in rural northeastern Maine every August to harvest wild blueberries. Many stay in one of several company-owned camps right in the middle of the blueberry barrens, as these 46,000-odd acres of fields are called. The harvest is a remarkable convergence of people from across the continent, including those native to the region on both sides of the Canadian-American border, and migrant farm workers from Central America and the Caribbean. The blueberries they harvest are distinct from those you might see year-round in the supermarket. The most common commercially grown blueberry is the highbush, a tall native shrub that can be planted and cultivated in several and different climates. By contrast, wild blueberries are not planted, but grown naturally as a ground cover from North Carolina to Canada. They thrive especially well in the coarse, acidic soils of northeastern or down east Maine. Smaller and sweeter than highbush blueberries, wild blueberries are high in antioxidants and are considered one of the most nutritious foods on Earth. For thousands of years, the 5 tribal nations of the Wabanaki peoples, the Mi'kmaq, Maliseet, Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, and Abenaki have harvested these wild blueberries in late summer. Traditionally, they use their hands or handheld rakes, which look something like a dustpan with fine metal teeth. The berries are a part of their seasonal foodways, eaten fresh, preserved for winter, stewed into tea, and cough syrup, and used as a dye. The Wabanaki, whose ancestral homelands stretch across eastern Canada and New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont, have long encouraged wild blueberry growth through prescribed burning, a practice later adopted by Europeans who settled on their lands. During the American Civil War, the blueberries were used to feed the Union Army, soon driving a robust canning industry. Since then, the wild blueberry industry has been central to both the economy and culture of Maine, contributing tens of millions of dollars to the state's economy every year. But commercial growers around the world are increasingly planting highbush blueberries year-round, crowding the market. And in Maine, wild blueberry farmers are switching to large harvesting machines to keep up with industry competition at the same time as climate change is leading to earlier harvests, high heat, periodic drought, and a decline in native bee populations that are essential for pollination. These shifting economic ecological and social conditions have led to a precarious future for this traditional harvest. As a sociologist studying the effects of climate change on rural livelihoods, I wanted to understand how shifting weather patterns might be changing this industry, but I also wanted to experience firsthand the unusual mingling of cultures that the harvest relies upon. The demographics have shifted significantly in the last several decades. Several thousand migrant and seasonal workers, including Wabanaki harvesters, now participate in the wild blueberry harvest, either hand-raking blueberries, processing and freezing berries, or driving harvesting machines. Although reliable demographic data is sparse, the most recent survey, conducted by the Maine Department of Labor in 2015, suggests that seasonal and migrant workers make up around 17% of all hired farm labor in Maine. Most were born in Mexico. Others come from Haiti, Honduras, and El Salvador. In addition to perhaps hundreds of Wabanaki harvesters, many workers follow the growing seasons up the East Coast, harvesting fruit and vegetables. Some stay in Maine through the winter, collecting balsam fir branches for wreaths or working in the seafood processing industry. While their labor is essential, their work often goes unacknowledged in this predominantly white state. I don't think a lot of people know who are the folks picking the food for them in the field, says Juana Rodriguez-Vasquez, executive director of Mano en Mano, an organization that connects immigrants and farm workers in Maine to essential services such as housing and health care. I don't think it's often valued as it should be. April Norton of Wyman's, among the largest producers of wild blueberries in the state, told me, "Our migrant and seasonal workforce is critical to the viability of our organization. Without them, we would not get this harvest." I visited the Blueberry Barrens during the first week of the harvest, arriving at the Passamaquoddy Wild Blueberry Company headquarters in Columbia Falls at 7 a.m. The company, owned and operated by the Passamaquoddy tribe, cultivates 2,000 acres of blueberry fields. The land is just a portion of ancestral territory, first seized by Massachusetts and then Maine beginning in the 17th century. It was repurchased by the tribe in the 1980s, using funds earmarked by Congress after lawmakers approved a settlement between Maine and the Wabanaki tribes. The two sides remain at odds over aspects of settlement's implementation, including a provision that hinders Wabanaki citizens of Maine from accessing federal benefits established for Indian tribes. At the camp, I met Darren Paul, the company's general manager, who led me to a shed full of hand rakes. We found one that seemed to fit my hand and wasn't too heavy, then hopped in his truck. Soon, a company camp came into view, a collection of 20 simple wood cabins that housed rakers and their families during the harvest. Picnic tables and lawn chairs were set up outside. In a cabin decorated with strings of lights, I met Stephanie Bailey, 50, a Passamaquoddy harvest supervisor from Indian Township, known as Motokomikuk in Passamaquoddy, an hour north of here. In Bailey's kitchen, I sat at a picnic table with Connor, a Passamaquoddy teenager also from Indian Township, who, like me, was preparing for his first harvest, and a family from the Eskasoni First Nation, who have come for over the past 40 years. When the family shared that they have stayed in the same cabin for the last 20 years, Bailey beamed. "I love that so much," she said. Before we could begin raking, Bailey taught us about how to spray pesticides and how to avoid spreading them from berries to our skin. I asked Connor what he knew about the history of blueberry harvesting and his people. "Nothing," he said. This wasn't surprising. Bailey recalled that her grandfather was punished by church authorities for hunting and foraging for his meals, part of a legacy of government-sponsored attempts dating to 1879 to replace indigenous cultures with Christian culture. As recently as the 1970s, Wabanaki children were forced to attend boarding schools where they were forbidden from speaking their native language or otherwise expressing their culture, and were frequently subjected to physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. Even in schools on the reservation, Wabanaki people were prohibited from speaking their native languages or eating traditional foods. "We were literally taught that you're going to jail if you provide for yourself in the way that we've done for thousands of years," Bailey told me. This was hardly an unusual practice, as the Potawatomi Nation scholar Kyle Powys White wrote in 2017. "One of the common strategies of erasure is to erase indigenous people's food systems." In 2013, in an attempt to redress ongoing wrongs, Maine Governor Paul LePage and chiefs from five Wabanaki tribes established a first-of-its-kind Truth and Reconciliation Commission in the United States, which jointly investigated the state's continued removal of Wabanaki children from their communities. For example, between 2000 and 2013, the commission found Maine's Child Welfare Agency separated Wabanaki children from their families via the foster care system as a rate up to five times higher than non-Native children. On his first day at the harvest, Johnson, the fisherman from Nova Scotia, was handed a rake. Then a few other harvesters showed him how to bend over, scooping using first his back, then his legs. Like a crab or something, he told me. Blueberry workers make a set amount of money per box, which each weighs about 20 pounds when filled. The rate for a box varies slightly from company to company, but overall rates across the industry have remained virtually unchanged for three decades. At the Passamaquoddy Wild Blueberry Company, it's currently set at $2.75. Johnson could not believe how hard the work was, but he filled 55 boxes of blueberries on his first day. Back at the camp, there was a bonfire and a potluck dinner. Families played outside. Johnson told me that apart from a joke some of the guys made about how a bear was going to get him on his way to the outhouse, a threat that never materialized, he didn't worry about much. "I went there with nothing, and people were feeding me," he said. "I couldn't believe how nice they were. It felt good to be there. It felt like I reconnected with my ancestors." On my first day out in the fields, I met John Gugu, a crew supervisor. Gugu gave me a lesson in the two raking styles, scooping and sweeping. Sweeping is for advanced rakers who crouch and sweep the rake at an angle across their body, a long glide across the top of the berries, almost a dance. Scooping is a shorter movement, reaching the rake's teeth underneath the berries, then pulling back up toward your body. Gugu says that most rakers fill between 40 and 50 boxers each day. I said I was going for five. He got four boxes for me and set them on the ground. As he walked away, I picked up the rake and gave it a try, but I mainly pulled up rocks and soil. Next, I positioned the fingers of the rake slightly higher, but I still ended up raking ground. Gugu's wife, Brenda, rushed over. "Try not to dig up the whole plant," she said. It finally clicked that it's called scooping because you have to move the rake downward at an angle, then pull it back up and toward you, like scooping ice cream. I moved up and across the field, scooping and lifting, dropping the berries in the boxes, and pulling out errant grasses. On either side of me, harvesters chatted in Mi'kmaq and Spanish. Although the Passamaquoddy Wild Blueberry Company mostly cultivates conventional wild blueberries now to keep up with the industry, I was put on an organic blueberry field. Without pesticides, these sections are full of weeds and are considered much harder work. By the end of the day, I had filled 15 boxes of berries and could barely walk. The next morning, I visited the Blueberry Harvest School, run by Mano Imano in Millbridge. The school operates as a hub for working families during the three-week harvest, transporting dozens of students from Blueberry Company camps and several nearby towns. While their parents are in the fields, the children read, visit the playground, have class in the woods, and take field trips to local beaches and water parks. Remarkably, the school offers instruction in three languages, Spanish, English, and Mi'kmaq/Passamaquoddy. Although distinct, the languages are very similar. In Maggie Burgos's combined second and third grade class, students colored, played Legos, and read books as they settled into their day. "There's a lot of movement in what their families do for work," she said. "I've learned from a lot of students that coming to Blueberry Harvest School feels like a constant in their year." Once each student arrived, the class gathered in a circle on soft floor mats. We each took a turn saying our name and the language we felt most comfortable speaking. For most students, this was Mi'kmaq or Spanish. Burgos then read a book about weaving traditions around the world. Wabanaki people are known for their baskets, often woven from strips of brown ash trees and gathered sweetgrass. In the afternoon, the students practiced making their own weavings with paper before moving on to cloth. Finally, Burgos asked each student to name one thing that they love. One student, a Mi'kmaq boy who had been fidgeting on his mat, said, "I love everyone in this classroom." In recent years, as spring and fall have become warmer, the blueberry season has shifted too. Harvest used to be exclusively in August. Some rakers recall once waking up to trace ice on the berries in the morning. But these days, the harvest routinely starts earlier. Last year, it began in mid-July, and that was after a late frost had damaged many flowering blueberry plants, drastically reducing the year's yields. The 3 years before that had seen drought and heat levels rarely recorded, requiring growers to invest in more irrigation technology, a major financial expenditure that also depletes precious groundwater. Whereas summers in down East Maine used to be relatively cool, 80 to 85 degree days are now common, which impacts the quality of the berries and the ability of the harvesters to work. This stresses plants and people alike. And the ideal growing conditions for wild blueberries are moving north from Maine into Canada. Although scientists at the University of Maine are analyzing how berries respond to heat stress and excessive precipitation, in order to help growers predict how probable climate scenarios will impact their blueberries, there are no easy solutions. If the industry is going to stay here in Maine, there are more steps we need to take to create field tools that help farmers continue farming. For example, automated alerts that warn of damaging frost, says Lily Calderwood, a wild blueberry specialist at the university. When the harvest is over, the blueberry fields turn bright red as autumn settles in. In the winter, a wind-whipped snow settles on them. It was in this season of dormancy that I spoke with Bailey again over FaceTime. She sat beside her wood stove in her home in Indian Township. She spoke about the sense of community at the Barrens she remembered from when she would go as a girl to pick blueberries every summer with her grandmother. "I go there to make the community that I remember and to connect with people the way I used to," she said. She runs a store at the Blueberry Camp, for example, where rakers can buy affordable food on credit, and she organizes meals to ensure that everyone is fed. "People don't always show up with much money, so I always make sure when I'm bringing a meal, I'm bringing enough to feed everybody." She is also keenly aware of the time, not so long ago, when her people were not allowed to celebrate their culture. She now brings her grandchildren to the harvest, where they attend the blueberry harvest school during the day and play at the camps at night. "I'm able to create community here," she said. "Culture isn't stagnant." Next, we'll move on to an article in the prologue section titled "Ballpark Figure" by Fred Frommer. Major League Baseball's official historian is expanding our understanding of the game's origins. Baseball, more than any other sport, is grounded in history, built on legend, an enduring portal into the past. So it made a certain sense in 1999 when Major League Baseball's ninth commissioner, Bud Selig, created an unusual position in pro sports, ensuring that this most classic of American games would have an official in-house historian. Selig first tapped the encyclopedic knowledge of Jerome Holtzman, who had just retired as a longtime baseball writer and columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times and Chicago Tribune. Holtzman, a Chicago native, held his post until his death in 2008. But it's arguably MLB's second and current official historian, John Thorne, who has truly defined the role, from developing new mathematical ways of understanding the sport to pushing our knowledge of baseball roots further and further back into the past. Thorne was born in a displaced persons camp in Germany in 1947. The son of Jewish parents from Poland who were conscripted into forced labor after Germany invaded in 1939. The family wound up immigrating to the United States in 1949 when Thorne was still a toddler. As an immigrant, you want to be an American, but more broadly, you want to be part of the team. You want to be part of the group. You want to have some sort of shared endeavor, and baseball seemed to supply that model more than almost anything, Thorne says. He remembers one early baseball experience with glittering clarity. It was an afternoon in 1959 in the Forest Hills section of Queens, New York. He was holding down center field when an opposing batter launched a drive over his head. "I turned fully, racing with my back to the infield, stuck out my glove, and the ball landed in it," he recalls. "In baseball, I thought, anything could happen. Even I could be a hero." Baseball provided an outlet for the young immigrant boy to fit in, not just on the diamond in Queens, but earlier in his Bronx neighborhood. There, he would flip baseball cards with other kids toward the wall of his apartment house. The card flipped nearest to the wall won, and Thorne proudly recalls once winning a Jackie Robinson card. Through these routines, Thorne says, I felt a part of something larger than myself, my family, my street. I was one of the gang. Though he was raised in the Bronx, home of the Yankees, Thorne grew up rooting for the Brooklyn Dodgers, largely because of Robinson, who broke baseball's color barrier on April 15, 1947, 2 days before Thorne was born. Even as a young boy, keenly conscious of his identity as an immigrant and outsider, he already felt a strong kinship to Robinson. We were brothers under the skin. Thorne's family moved from the Bronx to Queens in 1954, and he soon had dreams of becoming an explorer who might roam the world unearthing buried treasures, something he would do with striking success as a baseball historian. First, though, Thorne brought his passion for discovery to the study of literary history. For 1 year, beginning in 1968, he pursued a doctorate at Washington University in St. Louis, planning to write his dissertation about George Herbert, the 17th century English metaphysical poet, whose Thorne says satisfied an antiquarian bent, the one that would morph into my study of American history and notably baseball. Then in 1969, he had a career epiphany while working on his dissertation. I was having a hard time with the thesis because the Mets were marching to the pennant. He recalls referring to the Miracle Mets, who would win their first World Series that fall in one of the biggest upsets in sports history. I came to realize that I cared more about the Mets than I did about Herbert or metaphysical poetry. As fate would have it, one of his professors recommended an editorial opening at the New Leader, a biweekly magazine about politics and culture, and Thorne jumped at the chance. He wound up working there as an editor from 1969 to 1972. But it was his next gig as an editor at Hart Publishing, where his love of baseball finally dovetailed with his professional work. The company asked him to refresh a 1950 book called Big Time Baseball, soon republished as A Century of Baseball Lore with Thorne as the author. The book, a work of deep and quirky detail, marked the official start of Thorne's personal quest into baseball history. It was a silly little book written on assignment with a specific mandate to match the style of the standing material, Thorne says. But one faintly amusing story after another, it struck me, even then, built up into folklore of both the nation and its favorite pastime. As Thorne pursued deeper historical research into baseball, he also came to redefine its relationship with statistics, often in concert with the pioneering baseball analyst Pete Palmer. Thorne and Palmer shared a passionate belief that advanced stats could help more accurately illuminate a player's performance. One example is what's called ultimate zone rating, which seeks to quantify how many runs a fielder has saved. In 1984, Palmer and Thorne came out with their first book together, The Hidden Game of Baseball, which later statisticians credited with inspiring much of the ensuing statistical revolution by creating sophisticated new ways to measure player performance. In 1989, the duo published Total Baseball, an invaluable book for the pre-internet age that provided exhaustive lists of player stats dating back to the 19th century. It was a sensation, giving an untold number of American kids reams of statistical treasure to pore over and memorize. Total Baseball is one of several dozen books that Thorne has written, edited, or anthologized. By the time Total Baseball appeared, Thorne and colleague Bill James were becoming rock stars in the growing field of sabermetrics, named for the Society for American Baseball Research, or SABR, which relies on quantifiable evidence to determine which players have the most promise, for example, a high on-base percentage, as well as which plays tend to have lower yields, sacrificial bunts. As the New York Times gushed in 1989, Bill James and John Thorne have popularized, if not revolutionized, the way baseball is viewed and discussed. Over the ensuing decades, Thorne continued to quietly reshape how fans, sports writers, and industry insiders observed, interpreted, and anticipated baseball in books and talks, also appearing as an expert in Ken Burns' mammoth 1994 documentary Baseball. Then, in 2003, he came upon a most precious piece of buried treasure, the sort he had been seeking since he was a boy, the first known reference to the game called baseball being played in the United States. While researching a book on the origins of the sport, Thorne had chanced upon an 1869 history of Pittsfield, Massachusetts, covering the years of 1734 to 1800. The Pittsfield History referred to a 1793 document that mentioned baseball. With prodding from the late major league pitcher Jim Bouton, who then lived about 25 miles from Pittsfield, a city librarian and others looked for this document among the town council's minutes from the 18th century. After 10 days of searching, they finally found a vintage bylaw that mentioned baseball, which turned out to be from 1791, and which painted the sport in an unflattering light. The Pittsfield law flagged the young game as a nuisance that needed regulating, banning people from playing baseball and other ball games within 80 yards of the new town meeting house to protect the building's windows. The discovery helped vault Thorne to greater fame than before and establish him as the expert on almost any question about the game. Increasingly, the earlier years of baseball became his main area of research and led to his 2011 book, Baseball in the Garden of Eden, The Secret History of the Early Game. An exceptionally thorough work written in a breezy style and filled with innumerably delightful and surprising facts. Among them is his note that an ancient forerunners to the game, bat and ball games go back to the banks of the Nile nearly 4,500 years ago in the game Sikr Hamat, or batting the ball. In a review, the New York Times concluded that Thorne can probably lay claim to knowing more baseball minutiae than any other living human. Others noticed, too. The year Baseball in the Garden of Eden was published, Selig tapped Thorne as MLB's second official historian. John Thorne has been brilliant, says Selig, who now teaches baseball history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Arizona State. I have a theory that one of the big problems in life is that people don't understand the history of things, Selig says. And if you don't understand the history, how can you understand what's happening? He adds, I can't emphasize enough how much Thorne's expertise has helped on real issues that we're talking about. Today, Thorne's responsibilities include research, writing a blog, and doing media interviews, but his outreach also centrally includes hunting down the answers to queries posed by fans. One regular question is whether Babe Ruth should have been credited with 715 home runs or 714. In 1918, playing for the Boston Red Sox, Ruth hit a walk-off homer with one man on base, by modern standards, a home run. Yet before 1920, the game ended with the winning run scored, so Ruth was credited with a measly triple. Thorne will explain this history to fans, along with his opinion that Ruth really did hit 715 homers. Thorne is not afraid to use the modern tools of baseball analytics to take a fresh look at some of the game's other biggest icons, such as Yankees Hall of Famer Joe DiMaggio. On the occasion of DiMaggio's 100th birthday in 2014, Thorne argued that the player wasn't the elite center fielder he's cracked up to be. According to the MLB Network, he said, if you look at DiMaggio's range factor, he never let the American lead, and he never even finished second once. Brian Kenny, a host for the network, pushed back the next day. I don't want the next generation to think DiMaggio was some sort of fraud and he was trumped up because he was popular and he married Marilyn Monroe. This guy from 1936 to 42 is the best player in baseball quantifiably. Spirited debate is one of the great things about baseball, Thorne says. Only one who has busted myths will recognize their power, their hold on imagination. Legends command respect, but evidence is good, too. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading from the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.